So back to the synthesis of yoga. We're in the Yoga of Divine Works, and we've come to chapter 11, the master of the work. Published originally on the 15th of October in 1915, he considerably reworked this chapter. We might note that there being a master of the work connotes that there is an existent who is a great person. That the nature of personhood in Vedantic thinking extends from transcendent reality into cosmic station and into the individual person. All have personal attributes. Vedanta, in its original formulation in the Upanishads, the end of the Veda, hence the Upanishads, were not theologically or philosophically antagonistic to the idea of a personal Godhead. Their idea was never the theistic notions that we see in Judaism, Christianity, or Islam, where a God superior to the world creates it, for instance, out of nothing, and but stands aloof from the subject, the object of its creation. Rather, the person as he, she, it is understood throughout Indian thinking in the Upanishads is inside the universe, as well as transcendent to the universe, and is stationed in each person. This is where the Gita, the Bhagavad Gita, gets the thread of its idea and how to unite all the persons, the transcendent, the Purushottama, the cosmic person who stands as the spiritual reality supporting all manifestation, and the individual person moving through space and time. So the Kshara, the Akshara, and the Purushottama all are united. It's not explicit in the Upanishads, but it is quite explicit in the Bhagavad Gita. And it's to the Gita that Sri Aurobindo most often turns when he's looking for supporting scriptural authority. Tonight we're going to draw attention a bit to the Shvetashvatara Upanishad because it has many elements within its verses which are akin to what we read in the Bhagavad Gita. So as we go through this, we'll note here and there some of the textual resonance. So, chapter 11, The Master of the Work. The master and mover of our works is the One, the universal and supreme, the eternal and infinite. And this goes to the Shvetashvatara in the first adhyaya, the first chapter, in the 10th verse. But it also goes to the Isha Upanishad in its opening verse. It goes to the Bhagavad Gita in chapter 4, shloka 6, and it even has more resonance later in the Shvetashvatara in the third and the eighth verses in the same opening chapter. So there is one who is stationed in all things, the universal, so he must be in all things, supreme, beyond all things, eternal, and infinite. So, supreme, eternal, and infinite. The transcendent reality, which has no perishing feature to it. That world is not subject to decay and death. Nevertheless, the master and mover of our works is here with us in the universal. Back to the supreme. He is the transcendent unknown or unknowable absolute, the unexpressed and unmanifested ineffable above us. But he is also the self of all beings, the master of all worlds, transcending all worlds, the light and the guide, the all-beautiful and all-blissful, the beloved and the lover. You remember in The Life Divine, Sri Aurobindo opens a study of the nature of being with the acknowledgement that we can say sat, but we can also say asat. It is, the Supreme is a reality, but by defining itself, by saying I am, by saying this is, it is still free of even that assignation and escapes and is an unknowable. What is not the sat? Hence, asat. Not that all being is blanked out, because sat does come into being, and out of non-being, nothing can come. A different Upanishad contradicts the one that asserts that. Sri Aurobindo accepts both and explains them in that way. So it is a transcendent, which is not knowable to the mind. Unexpressed, unmanifested. Remember? Manifest means to bring forward, to make visible, to make plain to the view. What is unmanifested is kept behind. The mind fashions things in terms of mathematics and words to understand, but the reality, the supreme, is ineffable. It can't be spoken. Just like you have the experience, the mystic experience of the oneness of all things, whatever you say will fall flat by comparison with the experience of it. You can't capture it in words. Sri Aurobindo himself, master writer though he was, says the same thing. He continues, but he, that supreme, is also the self of all beings. So there's a common self. There is one self, universally distributed, in the manifestation of the many, of the individuals. They all rest in a common being. This is the self, the Atman. But while being there, impartite and supporting all, undivided and supporting all, this self is nevertheless the master, Isha, supreme above it. If it's the self of all beings, it's Atma Samsta, the Shvetashvatara, again in the first Adhyaya, and that's the 12th verse. The master of all worlds, the Isha Upanishad, again the opening verse. Transcending all worlds, that's Bhagavad Gita. The light and the guide, again Bhagavad Gita, the all beautiful and all blissful, the beloved and the lover. This carries us right into the Puranic systems beyond the time span of Vedanta, coming closer to us in age. He is the cosmic spirit, Shvetashvatara Upanishad, 3rd Adhyaya, 7th verse. So a transcendent who is also the cosmos. So coming into time and space, but in a large way. And all creating energy around us, not just the existence, not just sat, but it is also the power that makes sat go. So that is the Shakti. He is the immanent within us, that all-supporting reality. This is the Akshara Purusha, the Atman, Brahman, in whom all have a home. All that is he. And he is the more than all that is. And we ourselves, though we know it not, are being of his being, force of his force, conscious with a consciousness derived from his. Even our mortal existence is made out of his substance, and there is an immortal within us that is a spark of the light and bliss that are forever. No matter whether by knowledge, works, love, or any other means, to become aware of this truth of our being, to realize it, to make it effective here or elsewhere, is the object of all yoga. So, pick your text, Shvetashvatara Upanishad 1:16, Bhagavad Gita, 9th chapter, 4th verse. This is all that is, Isha Upanishad. All this is the habitation of the Lord of Isha. But that vast light, described like a sun, finds and implants us with a spark of its own reality. So always within it, we carry latent, even if it is not visible, the power of that light, which means that the light, having radiated here, can radiate back. To make it effective here or elsewhere is the object of all yoga. And this is the case. Yoga aims at the recognition of this eternal reality. If you don't get that, then the yogas, at least those that aim at enlightenment and liberation, would fall utterly to the side. But how do we get there? We all begin fixed in body and ego and have to grow beyond desire towards the infinity of the spirit. So the opening stages that we see traced out in these ancient texts thousands of years ago are still relevant to us here. We all have to do that. However humanity might have evolved and progressed in recent millenniums, these basic truths are still before us. We start from the body. We start seemingly immersed in ignorance, and we have to find within this shambling figure a glory, a courage to grow, a blissful soul, and live beyond decay and death and circumstance, and find the happiness within, and find that the felicity that is impartable to the soul offers us the very staircase by which we climb back to the Supreme. Now, what's interesting is that this soul, this spark, is what unites spirit and matter. It is that intersection inside the conscious soul where all problems are reconciled. All antinomies come back to oneness. So living from the soul is the very answer that the cosmos expects us to deliver to its questions. Is there a world? Is there a reality? Is there a purpose? It isn't a puzzle for the mind, it's a challenge for the soul. This first paragraph, Sri Aurobindo completely added in his revision. Some of the next, of course, comes from his original essay. He begins it more or less by saying, "The master reveals himself." Well, we'll come to that in a second. "But the passage is long and the labor arduous. Before we can look on him with eyes that see true, and still longer and more arduous must be our endeavor if we would rebuild ourselves in his true image. The master of the work does not reveal himself at once to the seeker." But there is the idea that the Gita brings directly to us, in which Sri Aurobindo stresses in his own integral yoga, that the Purushottama calls the aspiring soul in the form of Arjuna. Says, "You must live beyond your ego, leave desire behind, and in a spiritual state of oneness with reality, continue to work in the world and arrive at union with me, the Supreme. And in that union with me, you also will be timeless, but in time. You also will be one with all and yet sustain your individuality. Continue to fulfill your dharma in the world, the role, the mission, the work that I gave to you, while you are at one with the universe and while you are undivided in awareness in me in knowledge at one, in me in love at one, in me really in the substance of your being at one. Always," Sri Aurobindo writes, "it is his power that acts behind the veil, but it is manifest only when we renounce the egoism of the worker, and its direct movement increases in proportion as that renunciation becomes more and more complete." So, if it is always the Supreme acting through the agency of circumstances, then the end is known. The goal is sure. The victory will come when the divine says it will. The auspicious moment will arrive. But it can become manifest, that is, plain to the view, only when we renounce the egoism of the worker, because that's what divides us. It's our struggle to maintain control and to be in charge and to get the credit for the work and to eat the fruit of the work that is, you know, necessary to get started on the process of individuation, but then becomes the block to stop us from reaching unification. So that we have to give up. But it isn't a renunciation of the typical kind that we see in the world, where we say, "I won't eat chocolate anymore, I'm not going to drink coffee anymore." This is an inner renunciation that Sri Aurobindo is referring to here. It is not sannyasa, it is tyaga from the Gita. Only when our surrender to his divine shakti is absolute shall we have the right to live in his absolute presence. And only then can we see our work throw itself naturally, completely, and simply into the mold of the divine will. Absent division, then that moves smoothly through us. Shvetashvatara Upanishad, fourth adhyaya, first verse. There must therefore be stages and gradations in our approach to this perfection, as there are in the progress towards all other perfection on any plane of nature. The vision of the full glory may come to us before, suddenly or slowly, once or often. But until the foundation is complete, it is a summary and concentrated, not a durable and all-enveloping experience, not a lasting presence. The amplitudes, the infinite contents of the divine revelation come afterwards and unroll gradually their power and their significance. Or even, the steady vision can be there on the summits of our nature, but the perfect response of the lower members comes only by degrees. In all yoga, the first requisites are faith and patience. The ardors of the heart and the violences of the eager will that seek to take the kingdom of heaven by storm can have miserable reactions if they disdain to support their vehemence on these humbler and quieter auxiliaries. And in the long and difficult integral yoga, there must be an integral faith and an unshakable patience. So Sri Aurobindo himself began with a rather sudden and stark realization. But that achievement did not secure the liberation of all the members of his being. As he worked to establish that experience in all the levels of his nature, emotionally, energetically, even physically, he found that that was a sadhana all by itself, let alone climbing into conscious awareness of this. But if there's to be an integral yoga, then there's no part of the being that can be left out. And what the soul experiences, what the liberated mind experiences, has to become part of the normal experience of every facet of the being, which means the work is unending. There is no off time. You don't sit and say, now I have realized, where's a nice stone upon which to sit and I'll never have to move again. It's virtually endless. Sri Aurobindo says to achieve this throughout the nature, you have to have faith and patience. Interestingly, when we read now, you know, the record of yoga, the Sapta Chatushtaya, the seven quartets, I guess, these two, faith and patience, are central in the first and the second Chatushtaya. Faith, Shraddha, patience, titiksha, endurance, sticking with it, not getting discouraged. If you have to do it 1,000 times, you'll do it 1,000 times. If you take a step forward and it rebounds on you, resiles on you, then you take that step again. It is difficult to acquire or to practice this faith and steadfastness on the rough and narrow path of yoga because of the impatience of both heart and mind and the eager but soon faltering will of our rajasic nature. Difficult to practice. For Sri Aurobindo, when he defines yoga, this is not the yoga that aims at an escape from the world. Remember, the context is always life-affirming, accepting circumstances as they are, the world as it is and working towards this union. But even if it were a shramanic path, a path of renunciation, like with Advaita Vedanta, the sannyasis, Buddhists who take up the robe, become monks, that path also is not easy. But the integral yoga is supremely challenging. You're not aiming at the liberation of one part of your being. You're aiming at all of it. The vital nature of man hungers always for the fruit of its labor. And if the fruit appears to be denied or long delayed, he loses faith in the ideal and in the guidance. For his mind judges always by the appearances, by the appearance of things. Since that is the first ingrained habit of the intellectual reason in which he so inordinately trusts. Nothing is easier for us than to accuse God in our hearts when we suffer long or stumble in the darkness, or to abjure the ideal that we have set before us. For we say, I have trusted to the highest, and I am betrayed into suffering and sin and error. Or else, I have staked my whole life on an idea which the stern facts of experience contradict and discourage. It would have been better to be as other men. It would have been better to be as other men are, who accept their limitations and walk on the firm ground of normal experience. Now, Sri Aurobindo wrote this in 1915, but it was to become a common experience years, decades later in the ashram, because people would take up the practice of the yoga and then say, all these things I renounced, and I've got nothing for it. I haven't realized my soul. I haven't done this. I haven't achieved that. And they repined their choice to take up the yoga. And the Bhagavad Gita has an interesting shloka. It's in the 9th chapter. It's the 3rd shloka, 3rd verse, couplet. If the faith is insufficient and you take up the yoga prematurely, let's say, not knowing that it demands a full-bore commitment, then there is a return to the former nature. In a sense, there's a fall from yoga. But it is intensely painful for someone who has ever seen the path that leads towards that, who has ever caught the scent, the fragrance of the divine presence, to ever be comfortable and at ease in the normal life, because something in the spirit has outgrown it, even if it stepped prematurely. So Sri Aurobindo's insistence here that faith and patience combine to support the practice is one of the things that is key to success in yoga. Build that faith. He goes on from here. In such moments, these moments where we weaken when we falter, in such moments, and they are sometimes frequent and long, all the higher experience is forgotten, and the heart concentrates itself in its own bitterness. It is in these dark passages that it is possible to fall for good or to turn back from the divine labor. If one has walked long and steadily in the path, the faith of the heart will remain under the fiercest adverse pressure. Even if it is concealed or apparently overborne, it will take the first opportunity to reemerge. For something higher then either heart or intellect upholds it in spite of the worst stumblings and through the most prolonged failure. But even to the experienced sattaka, such falterings or overcloudings bring a retardation of his progress, and they are exceedingly dangerous to the novice. It is therefore necessary from the beginning to understand and accept the arduous difficulty of the path, and to feel the need of a faith which to the intellect may seem blind, but yet is wiser than our reasoning intelligence. This is part of the surrender. For this faith is a support from above. It is the brilliant shadow thrown by a secret light. That exceeds the intellect and its data. It is the heart of a hidden knowledge that is not at the mercy of immediate appearances. He comes to this again in his letters, often writing that faith is a knowledge not born of the mind, but the soul's certainty that this is the step, this is the way, and I know it because I feel it. And reasoning may as well stop its chatter, because it will not dissuade the soul from its rightful step. If you try to get in its way, it will find a way, it will find a path around the impediment, and keep going. If it means laying down the life and starting a fresh one, it will not be stopped. The adventure is endless. The support from above. In Letters on Yoga, Volume 1, right now, we're reading about the Jivatman, the high self, which extends itself into the immortality of the soul here. So that eternal support is always there from above, giving the soul here the faith, the surety, because that is timeless and sees all the way. The heart of a hidden knowledge, that's the heart behind the heart that knows this. It feels it because it's cognate with it, with the victory at the end, the adventure of the consciousness, and the sovereign victory at the end. These are natural to the soul. Our faith, persevering, will be justified in its works and will be lifted and transfigured at last into the self-revelation of a divine knowledge. Always we must adhere to the injunction of the Gita. Yoga must be continually applied with a heart free from despondent seeking. Chapter 6, Shloka 23. Always we must repeat to the doubting intellect the promise of the Master. I will surely deliver thee from all sin and evil. Do not grieve. Bhagavad Gita 18:66. At the end, the flickerings of faith will cease, for we shall see his face and feel always the divine presence. And that also is said both in the Gita and in the Shvetashvatara Upanishad. We'll put our bookmarks there and continue next time. In Savitri this week, let's read from Book 1, the Book of Beginnings, in Canto 4, The Secret Knowledge, and we'll start on page 50. along a path of eons serpentine, in the coiled blackness of her nescient course, the earth goddess toils across the sands of time. A being is in her whom she hopes to know. A word speaks to her heart she cannot hear. A fate compels whose form she cannot see. In her unconscious orbit through the void, out of her mindless depths she strives to rise, a perilous life her gain, a struggling joy. A thought that can conceive but hardly knows arises slowly in her and creates the idea, the speech that labels more than it lights. A trembling gladness that is less than bliss invades from all this beauty that must die. Alarmed by the sorrow dragging at her feet and conscious of the high things not yet won, ever she nurses in her sleepless breast an inward urge that takes from her rest and peace. Ignorant and weary and invincible, she seeks through the soul's war and quivering pain the pure perfection her marred nature needs, a breath of Godhead on her stone and mire. A faith she craves that can survive defeat, the sweetness of a love that knows not death, the radiance of a truth forever sure. A light grows in her. She assumes a voice. Her state she learns to read and the act she has done, but the one needed truth eludes her grasp, herself, and all of which she is the sign. An inarticulate whisper drives her steps, of which she feels the force but not the sense. A few rare intimations come as guides, immense divining flashes cleave her brain, and sometimes in her hours of dream and muse, the truth that she has missed looks out on her as if far off and yet within her soul. A change comes near that flees from her surmise, and ever postponed compels attempt and hope, yet seems too great for mortal hope to dare. A vision meets her of supernal powers that draw her as if mighty kinsmen lost, approaching with a strange, great, luminous gaze. Then is she moved to all that she is not, and stretches arms to what was never hers. Outstretching arms to the unconscious void. Passionate she prays to invisible forms of gods, soliciting from dumb fate and toiling time what most she needs, what most exceeds her scope, a mind unvisited by illusion's gleams, a will expressive of soul's deity, a strength not forced to stumble by its speed, a joy that drags not sorrow as its shade. For these she yearns and feels them destined hers. Heaven's privilege she claims as her own right. Just is her claim, the all-witnessing gods approve, clear in a greater light than reason owns. Our intuitions are its title deeds. Our souls accept what our blind thoughts refuse. Earth's winged chimeras are truth's steeds in heaven. The impossible, God's sign of things to be. But few can look beyond the present state or overleap this matted hedge of sense. All that transpires on earth and all beyond are parts of an illimitable plan the One keeps in his heart and knows alone. Our outward happenings have their seed within, and even this random fate that imitates chance, this mass of unintelligible results, are the dumb graph of truths that work unseen. The laws of the unknown create the known. Namaste, Jai Ma.